The headlines. Reports say Britain's austerity drive is set to kill more than 1 million jobs. Afghanistan's Attorney General accuses the United States of interference in judicial affairs. 72 days into the oil spill, and BP and the United States government failed to cap the well. And in sports, Portugal crash out as Spain make it to the quarterfinals in the World Cup 2010 in South Africa. Hello, everybody. Those were the headlines of 100 Hours GMT, 5:30 in the morning, where I am in Tehran. This is Press TV. Well, leaked data shed more light on the consequences of the British government's latest austerity measures. A private treasury report says up to 1.3 million jobs will be lost across the UK over the next 5 years. Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne's proposed austerity budget will reportedly result in the disappearance of up to 700,000 jobs in the private sector alone. Last week, Osborne outlined plans to shave nearly $9 billion off the national deficit this year. His proposal includes a recruitment freeze across the civil service. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Professor Edward Nell. He is with New School University, joining us on the phone from New York. Professor, it's good to have you with us. The UK is set to lose 1.3 million jobs, as I said, because of the austerity drive. How would this affect the country's political and social spheres, especially given the renewed fears of a global economic slowdown? Professor.
Well, I think this could very well contribute to a global slowdown, especially if the Germans also follow through on an austerity program. The Obama administration tried to forestall this at the G20 meetings, but they didn't have very much success. You only have to look at the Irish economy, which adopted austerity measures 2 years ago and saw their unemployment rate increased dramatically, and that the costs of borrowing, which austerity is supposed to help, actually rose by 3 percentage points. This is a very foolish move, and I think that the British public will, in fact, reject this. I think that the government will find themselves increasingly unpopular. It'll take a while because the Labour government was unpopular, and so having a new government, particularly what seems like an exciting new combination of the traditional Tory party with the Liberals, Liberal Democrats, but I think that honeymoon will wear off very quickly in the face of this budget.
Okay, Professor, let's discuss the situation of the world markets. They have fallen across the world amid fears. Fresh concerns, I should say, over the global economic recovery. Where do you think the situation is headed, Professor?
Well, I think it's very important to distinguish between what might be called ideological speech and analysis. Many, many journalists and many, many conservative commentators and many businessmen preach of the virtues of austerity and the importance of controlling debt. But when they actually come to make business decisions, things depend very much on how markets are developing. If demand is weak, this is a bad situation. These austerity moves, are weakening demand worldwide. That means we are going to have countries that export are going to have weaker exports. Business is going to face weaker sales. There's going to be the necessity of laying off more workers, so unemployment is going to rise. We are headed in the direction of a double dip, a second dip in the recession or depression. Actually, Paul Krugman has talked about the third Great Depression, the depression of the late 19th century, the depression of the 1930s, and now this looks like becoming the third Great Recession. And it really echoes what happened in 1931, 32, when the Hoover administration adopted austerity, and then in 1936, right after his re-election, Roosevelt adopted austerity measures and threw the economy into a tailspin for the last few years of the 1930s. So we've seen this before, and I'm afraid that the fact that this is very widespread, conservative governments and middle-of-the-road governments are saying we must control debts. And they're adopting a very foolish way of doing it, because what matters is not the debt, but the ratio of the debt to national income. And if you try to reduce spending, so to reduce your deficit by cutting back, you also reduce income, so the ratio doesn't get affected. The way to control debt is to expand so that the income, the output of the country, rises, that is the denominator, and then the ratio will look better. And that's what happened to the United States at the end of World War II. We had massive deficits and debts, and by expanding, by 1960, we were in a magnificent position.
Sorry, Professor, I'm sorry, just to because we were quickly running out of time, I'm going to have to stop
okay,
you there.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Professor, by the way. Professor Edward Nell with New School University in New York with those comments. Let's give you some other news, this time in Afghanistan, I believe. Afghanistan's Attorney General has accused the U.S. ambassador of threatening him with the loss of his job. This, if the highest legal authority in Afghanistan failed to take action against an Afghan banker. Attorney General Muhammad Ishaq Alko said Carl Eikenberry is violated diplomatic ethics. The U.S. ambassador claims banker Rafiullah Azimi is involved in a corruption case. Alko says his office does not have enough evidence against the banker. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul has refused to comment on the issue. Alko has also accused the United States and Britain of not cooperating with Kabul in arresting wanted Afghan officials who live abroad. Now, the bodies of seven British soldiers killed in Afghanistan last week have been flown back to the UK. This comes against the backdrop of mounting public anger over the war in that country. Thousands of mourners filled the streets of the small English town of Wootton Bassett to pay their final respects. Four of the soldiers were killed when their vehicle overturned into a river in Helmand province, and the other three were slain in separate attacks. Britain has deployed, of course, almost 10,000 troops to Afghanistan. Most of them are stationed in the Helmand province. More than 300 UK troopers have been killed in the war-torn country since the US-led invasion back in 2001. Six months ago, Taliban militants in Afghanistan kidnapped two French TV reporters and their three local support staff. Later, the militants released videotaped death threats against their captives. Meanwhile, in France, a campaign led by journalists is trying to secure the release of all five hostages now. Press TV's Marc Vautier is in Paris.
Hervé Guesquière and Stéphane Taponnier were making a television documentary about the work of the French army in Afghanistan. On December 29th last year, they, along with their local translator, assistant and driver, were ambushed and kidnapped by Taliban operatives.
I had this unexpected telephone call from my mother. She was in tears. My brother is mentally strong, but naturally we are worried sick. The last time we heard anything was a month ago.
The reporters were working for the French state-run television channel France 3. Bosses there teamed up with Reporters Without Frontiers, a non-governmental organization that fights for press freedoms and defends persecuted journalists all over the world.
The hostage situation of Hervé and Stéphane has become one of the longest hostage situations for French journalists. The last one longer was in Lebanon 30 years ago, so it's a very worrying situation.
Twice the Taliban have threatened to kill them. Only former kidnap victims in such circumstances can relate fully to the ordeal of being held by militants ready to end their captives' lives at a moment's notice.
I was worrying a lot for my family. I felt guilty about it and to be there.
And time in prison passes very, very slowly.
What do you do all day long is to wait for someone coming in with a little piece of bread, and that's your day.
Behind the scenes, French military and diplomatic authorities are trying to get the hostages released. France has nearly 4,000 troops and support staff stationed in Afghanistan, but casualties have been few, just over 40 in 9 years. Journalists in war zones risk all. They have the respect and admiration of their colleagues. Marc Vautier, Press TV, Paris.
The biggest oil spill in the United States history has now been going on for 72 days. Let's have a closer look at this issue.
There's still no promise that the gush of oil will permanently stop. This, as offshore containment efforts have been hampered in some parts of the Gulf of Mexico. Bad weather has brought cleanup operations to a halt near the coast of Louisiana. Scientists say as much as 100,000 barrels of crude continue to pour into the water every day. The impact on the environment has been profound.
It's very nasty, and I'm afraid it's going to be here for several years.
I think that's absolutely toxic. I wouldn't swim in. No, I mean, it's oil.
You got to think about, you know, I mean, all the fish that are dying out there, all the birds that are dying, you know, and that's going to never come back. You know, it's going to take years for that to come back.
The extent of damage to the wildlife and industry has been so huge that its scope is still unknown. Officials also say the spill's impact on tourism in the region could last for years. The U.S. says British oil giant BP is responsible for the disaster. The oil well began leaking after BP's Deepwater Horizon rig blew up on April 20th.
BP's liabilities for the spill are significant, and they acknowledge that fact. We will continue to hold BP and all other responsible parties accountable, and I'm absolutely confident BP will be able to meet its obligations to the Gulf Coast and to the American people.
We have agreed today with the President a framework that should assure the American people that we mean what we say.
Despite occasional assurances by officials, the public's anger with BP and the U.S. government is mounting as no tangible improvement is on the horizon.
I certainly think that BP as a company faces a Herculean task of rebuilding its reputation, because we have to remember that this particular disaster, while clearly being the largest oil spill in the world by now, is only the latest in a long list of security mishaps and other disasters that BP has experienced.
Moving on now, hundreds of Islamic scholars from 185 organizations are in Istanbul in Turkey for discussions on issues that affect the Muslim world. Press TV's Jody Sabral has the details.
The International Union for Muslim Scholars and Islamic NGOs have met in Istanbul for 2 days of discussions on issues concerning the Muslim world. This is the third gathering of its type and has brought together up to 600 Islamic scholars from over 50 countries. The Islamic Conference Organization has named 2010 and 2011 the year of the Quran, as this year, 1400 years ago, the Quran was revealed. All scholars will therefore re-examine Sharia to find guidance in what they described as critical times.
We need to know what's going, what is Sharia said, especially in this time. So maybe they can give us good directions, good light for our future. The nation or the world, as you see, is coming to very, very sensitive position, especially after what's happened in Gaza, in Palestine.
Critical times for the Palestinians indeed, as they continue to live under Israeli oppression, an issue that was brought to the attention of the international community after a Turkish aid flotilla was attacked by Israeli commandos in high waters last month, killing 9 humanitarian workers, injuring over 30. The General Secretary of IHH, the Turkish charity which organised the aid convoy, told Press TV he was hopeful the gathering would produce results with regards to how the Islamic world could aid the Palestinians.
Israel won't lift the blockade on Gaza, but the Islamic world must and can unite to do this, especially with Egyptian support. If not, we'll be forced to send more aid ships. I hope the Muslim world will unite with the help of scholars. I believe Israel is afraid of this. As you know, Israel remains by dividing the Islamic world. However, from now on, it won't be that easy.
Sunni and Shia Muslims gathered under this umbrella.
It's very important because this ulama is Muslimin, Islam ulama, and they are coming here to negotiate about, speak about the matters, I mean the problems of the Islamic world.
The conference addresses a list of issues that include the protection of Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds, and helping Muslims in war-torn countries such as Afghanistan and Iraq. Scholars told us texts from the Holy Quran would be examined and guidance would be sought at this critical juncture. Jody Sobral, Press TV, Istanbul.
Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah has met with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House. Press TV's Colin Campbell reports from Washington, D.C.
Peace in the Middle East was the headline between President Barack Obama and Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. They both agreed that they need to push for an accord between Israelis and Palestinians.
We have had a very productive session speaking about a whole range of issues that relate to both relations between our two countries, but also issues of prosperity and security around the globe.
The two leaders spoke before reporters after having lunch and a private meeting together. The U.S. president said that he and Abdullah discussed Afghanistan and Pakistan, efforts to fight extremism, and Iran's nuclear program.
A lot of the issues that were dividing the two countries at that time have either receded or been overcome or been taken off the table. The United States no longer thinks of, the government at least, no longer thinks of Saudi Arabia as responsible for terrorism.
King Abdullah is meeting President Obama at the White House for the first time, although the United States may be closest allies with Israel. When it comes to pursuing a peace plan there, King Abdullah could be considered President Obama's most important friend, not just on foreign policy, but also the economy.
It was only natural, it seems to me, that we would establish what I would call a more normal relationship. Saudi Arabia is a member of the G20, and in some ways they're like any other member of the G20.
We call for religious human rights.
But not everyone was pleased with the U.S.'s warm reception of the Saudi king. Demonstrators accused the monarchy of religious and women's rights oppression.
They say it's a religious reason why they shouldn't be able to drive or vote, which doesn't make any sense. They're using Sharia incorrectly. And so we want to give them their freedoms.
There were no major developments coming out of the White House meeting, but both leaders agreed on a common influence when King Abdullah prayed for the media. It may not have been a clear path on how to achieve peace in the Middle East, but they both hold an appreciation for an institution that plans to hold them accountable. For Press TV, Colin Campbell, Washington.
Much more news always can be found on our website, www.presstv.ir. That picture shows that we are moving towards the sports international section. Portugal moved out of the World Cup after losing 1-0 to Spain in the last match of round of 16. Amir Hossein is going to be here shortly with the latest on that event.